Okay, chapter 8, Resisting Evil. It begins with a quotation from Matthew 5:38, and the center of that quotation that Archbishop Averke comments on afterward, I would say is, I tell you not to resist an evil person. And what Archbishop Averke will do is to point out that when Jesus tells us not to resist an evil person, he is not telling us not to resist evil. You know, we're familiar with the idea that we distinguish between the person and the evil that a person can do. And what we can deal with directly is evil within ourselves. And as far as outside of ourselves, Archbishop Averke talks about the authorities that are in the world in order to deal with the evil that I can't do anything about. The evil that I can do something about is within me. He begins with this comment in the first sentence. It is common to consider the fundamental thought of this part of the Sermon on the Mount to be an expression, resist not evil. And he mentions that Count Leo Tolstoy understands it that way. Tolstoy, of course, author of War and Peace and other great works of literature in Russian, maintains that any resistance to evil, any suppression of evil in human society, except by means of verbal persuasion, is contrary to the gospel. And Archbishop Averke rejects that. And along with that goes in the center of the next page, page 99, a Christian, if he is truly a Christian, can never indifferently and calmly observe the triumph of evil and cannot accept evil. Jumping down about four lines, the struggle against evil in all its forms is the principal task of every Christian. A Christian battles with evil for the triumph of the good. The primary and fundamental task of a Christian is to battle with evil in his own soul. In his own soul. That's where we can primarily oppose evil. And until we do oppose evil in our own soul, we won't be able to be much use in dealing with evil outside of ourselves, because our tendency will be to condemn other people or to try to seek vengeance and say, well, this person has done an evil thing, and so I'm going to stop that person because they've done something that offends me because it's immoral. Something like that. That's not covered by what Jesus says. The battle with evil in his own soul and to suppress all evil impulses and yearnings therein. We Christians can never remain indifferent to evil wherever and in whatever form it appears. It is necessary only that the battle with evil be free from a personal component. So what does that mean, to be free from a personal component?
I guess you got to be objective about it. You're not have personal feelings about the person that might be evil.
Or not to do it for your own benefit.
Yeah, not do it for your own benefit.
Or for revenge or ulterior motives.
Right, any one of those would be ulterior motives, yeah. He specifically focuses on it shouldn't have anything to do with considerations of personal profit or gain. And I would say that includes the kind of gain that we get by being self-righteous about other people. It should be free from vindictiveness, from the desire to revenge ourselves upon someone disagreeable to us or who is our enemy. There's an awful lot of that in our society. Sharon and I were talking about on the way over how it's amazing that, and this is not our theology, but it is the theology of many denominational groups of Christians, that on the one hand we are corrupt and incapable of doing any good in harmony or in cooperation with God. If someone believes that as part of their Christian faith, how do they get to where they feel justified in condemning other people? Because aren't other people also corrupt? and incapable of doing as they ought to do. There's a lack of logic, it seems to me. And yet it seems very popular amongst exactly those people who believe, unlike the Orthodox, we believe that it is possible to cooperate with God's goodness, the goodness in Christ who reveals our true humanity. It's possible for us to cooperate with that newly revealed humanity and work in good ways along with him. But if you don't believe that's possible, doesn't it prohibit your judgment of others because they too are corrupt and incapable of doing good just like you are? How come there's so much free condemnation of other people by people who believe that we are incapable of acting in harmony with God to do good? This escapes me. Why this is the case. Mm-hmm. You know, we could do it ourselves too. I mean, you don't have to have that theology to condemn other people for doing things that are wrong in a self-righteous kind of way. Jesus' words, Archbishop Overky says, warn us against vindictiveness. Vindictiveness, what does that mean, to be vindictive?
Yes, I mean seeking
spiteful,
revenge.
Seeking revenge, holding a grudge, and feeling justified in treating another human being as though they are not a human being, less than you. Someone that deserves to be persecuted or harmed in by word or thought or deed because they are doing something that, as far as we're concerned, is not good. Striving to take revenge for ourselves, for a personal offense. We're not supposed to take offense. That is an evil in us. Constantly taking offense. We don't get to say, well, they made me do this, or, well, the reason I did this wrong thing that I'm going to confess in confession is because so-and-so said this, and that's why I did this, because I was offended, and so naturally I have a right to my honor, to my dignity, and, you know, all of that's nonsense. We don't. Christ never acted that way, and we're expected not to either. And then to justify it is even worse. And then to take it out on the other person as though it were not so that we are bound to follow Christ's, it has nothing to do with Christianity, but when people feel self-righteous, they feel justified in some way. A Christian is obligated to forgive personal offenses. Anything else changes our heart in a way that is not Christ-like. The Lord desires to put us on guard against being carried away by a personal, mutual enmity, kind of a long-standing attitude and condition of opposing someone else in a self-righteous kind of way, based on personal motives. We're setting ourselves up as though we were God in a way that God himself isn't. He teaches us to love one another, not only our friends, but also our enemies, and to this end, it is necessary to cast aside vindictiveness and forgive one another's personal offenses. Later on in the chapter, Archbishop Overky mentions that God reserves judgment of others or bringing others to justice to himself. It's not something that we have the right to do. Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, and God's vengeance will not be the way our kind of vengeance would be anyway. I mean, God's vengeance, what will it be? It will be to come and to be present before those who have made themselves unlike him, and the consequence will be, the vengeance will be, that it will be painful for them to be in the presence of the one who is good and holy and just, and the fact that God created us to be like him will be a source of pain and agony to any human being. That's God's vengeance. It's not the human kind of vengeance where we say, this is how you ought to be and I'm going to be the flail of the Lord. I'm going to give it to you on behalf of God. God can deal with that in his own way, and it's not in a human kind of way. The beginning of the last paragraph on page 100, learn how to forgive one another. Now, this is an important thing, I think, that we don't begin by knowing how to forgive one another. It's something that we have to learn. Learn how to forgive one another. If we learn how to forgive one another, our personal offenses, then evil will disappear from the face of the earth. Imagine, Archbishop Overky is claiming that if no one took personal offense, evil would disappear. That's quite a claim. Mm-hmm. Think about Satan, about Lucifer, about how he was offended by the first parents, offended against God, that they existed and that they were loved by God and that they were not just purely spiritual beings the way he was. You know, sometimes we think as though, we act as though we're purely spiritual beings when we're hypocritically in judgment of other people. But he really was a purely spiritual being. And here God created human beings, not just spiritual beings, but physical beings as well. And he was offended. Offense is the source of evil. Offense is being offended, is the root of evil, and it's based on pride. That's the source. So by dealing with our experience of feeling personally offended and being personally offended, we are dealing with the source of evil in our own heart, being offended because of our pride. That's something that we can only deal with ourselves. For this purpose, every person should work individually upon themselves for the erasing, the eradication, the elimination of evil in their own soul. We should eliminate, overcome the feeling of vindictiveness that is natural for our nature, damaged by sin. So this is how we resist evil within ourselves. I'm going to stop there and ask for people's thoughts on this first couple of three pages. Sharon mentioned this is a pretty straightforward chapter. It is a pretty straightforward chapter.
Well, I'm impressed with the consistency of the expression of the truth of the church, even more now after hearing this. I saw one of the saints said, if you forgive your brother, then your sin will not still be with you, but if you don't forgive your brother, then your sin will still be with you.
That's very good. I mean, I think it's, I can see the connection with what's been said here, and it's terrific to make the interpretation that you just did. That is based on our forgiveness of others, and that if we don't, then we're keeping the sin. The missing of the mark, you know, the consequences of doing that stays in our heart. It will lead to other examples of the same kind of action.
The phrase that you pointed out in the Sermon on the Mount, the quote from the beginning of the chapter, it seems to me that what we're discussing is learning to resist evil.
Right.
And not to resist. It seems like the problem that people have is resisting people.
Right. Which immediately sets us up in as superior to the other person,
right?
And equal to God, you know.
Well, there, yeah.
Who deals with us in a way that is different from the way that we're tempted to deal with as fallen human beings, right?
Yeah.
That we are. We must resist evil in order to be Christians. And he has advice for us as to how to resist evil. First of all, most directly within ourselves. But he also has rejection of Count Leo Tolstoy's idea that evil in the world needs to be resisted.
Right.
But it needs to be resisted as Christ would resist evil. Later on he talks about how the authorities that exist in the world are there because God has permitted them to be there. And the idea that we are going to oppose or reject the authorities of the world as individuals, it's very similar to opposing a person as evil instead of dealing with evil itself, when you think about it, because it sets us up in opposition to those authorities that God has permitted to exist. Not to say that everything he does talk about how recognizing that the authorities that exist in the world must understand that they are God's ministers. And he talks about war because governments have authority to use force against evil. Mm-hmm. As individuals,
we don't. Well, we talked a little bit last time about society and how what's more prevalent is this sort of political correctness kind of let everybody be however they want to be.
That would be Tolstoy.
But you know. But the it seems that the Christian calling includes exhorting one another, and in other words, not resisting the person, but resisting the evil within another person as well as resisting the evil within oneself.
How you go about that is maybe not gone into in as much depth as it could be. I mean, everything is not in one place, you know. There's some things in the Layman in the Desert book when he's talking about friendship and what friendship mm-hmm. is that I think speak directly to that. I made myself a note of that.
Yeah.
But yeah, our way of dealing with one another enables us to encourage one another toward a purity of heart. So the standard is always a personal standard when it comes to goodness. We could ask him if he were here, but we won't find it in this chapter. What do you think about governments forcing people to be virtuous? Is it possible to force people to be virtuous?
No.
You know, it's so we're going to pass some good laws here and force people to be, you know, John Calvin believed that because we are fallen and corrupt and incapable of doing good, I mean, by definition, it seems to me that a democratic republic is an impossibility. Calvin believed in an authoritative government and laws that force people to not go beyond certain limits. So I just don't know how you get from that kind of conviction that human beings are incapable of being good because they're corrupt to an open society. They don't mix, they don't blend. And there were political theories that assumed that that was the case. And Hobbes, Thomas Hobbes, whether or not he was religiously a Calvinist or not is open to dispute. But he wrote a book called Leviathan, and his claim was you need to have an authoritative government where people give up their absolute freedom to an authoritative government. Doesn't matter whether it's a king or whether it's a Calvinistic Protestant dictator like Oliver Cromwell, but somebody has got to have the authority to make sure that these totally corrupt people who don't have the capacity to be good to not go beyond the limit of certain laws. It seems to me that those things fit together very nicely, but it doesn't fit together with the idea that people should be trusted to be able to deal with evil within themselves. Now, the Founding Fathers didn't say that. Jefferson, he had a kind of a higher opinion of human nature in general. But we would say, you know, there was an idea, and I know I'm getting off here, but this country was intended to be what was called then in the 1700s a republic of virtue. It was based on the idea that people can be self-governing and can deal with themselves. If they couldn't, how could you have a democratic republic where people were given the freedom to govern themselves? You can't govern society if you can't govern yourself. That idea has somehow evaporated, that we can't have the kind of society that we have unless people are devoted to virtue. That's gone from the political conversation, but it's not gone from Archbishop Averke's assumptions about how society can function. It didn't need Jefferson and Adams and all the rest for Christians to have this conviction, or Orthodox Christians to have this conviction.
Well, it seems to me that as a general rule, if there's an authoritarian rule of good or virtue, that human nature is going to resist that. I mean, that's just from observation.
It seems like that would be according to one's subjective interpretation.
Yeah, people would react differently. Orthodox Christians down through the ages have lived under lots of different kinds of government and of course have been oppressed under probably more than 50% of them. What's that, Sharon?
And are currently being oppressed.
lots of places in the world. Yeah.
But that oppression is not necessarily authoritarian towards the good.
Well, they all think that their good is the good, as far as that goes, authority. Okay.
This all goes back to me, to emotion, to acting on and reacting to emotion.
The passions you have to deal with within yourself, right? Right. Part of resisting evil would be resisting your being controlled by passions, by emotions, by desires. I mean, emotions can be good or bad. They can be positive. They can be the love of God, the love of others. It's not simply an emotion. There's more to it than that. It's kind of like when Archbishop Averke talks about peace in this chapter. He makes a distinction between Christ's peace and any kind of worldly peace. If you have to negotiate with evil in order to have peace, then he would be against it. If there has to be some kind of compromise with evil in order to have what you would call peace, peace is not just people not shooting each other, as far as he's concerned. Christ's peace, you can't have it unless there's peace in the heart of a person. That reminds me again of Laman in the desert and the emphasis on friendship. It even fits in with that idea of nation of virtue. Okay, 56. Page 56 in this book, Laman in the Desert. He defines some things that I think are helpful. The Christian ideal, as far as people together, is friendship built on Christian love, Christian agape, kind of love that God has for us and the kind of love that we are intended to have, even for our enemies. The key thing that gets in the way is anger, because anger and love are opposite. You can't have anger and love in your heart at the same time. If you are angry, the anger drives out the love. And if you remind yourself of the nature of Christian love, the writer that he's referring to here is Abba Joseph, one of the Desert Fathers, will say, remind yourself of the nature of Christian love, and the anger will disperse. As soon as you are tempted to anger or begin to get angry, you can oppose that anger within yourself with Christian love. And this sort of love, Abba Joseph says, cannot be dissolved. It's insoluble. It can't be dissolved by anger. It will resist being dissolved by anger. Even death itself can't put an end to it. It is the true and unwavering affection that forms out of the perfection and virtue that is mirrored between two friends. And here his definition is, Christian love is nothing more or less than that which arises from a devotion to virtue shared between two friends. So if your friendship is based on a common love of some virtue, when we talk about friendship in a worldly sense, we talk about people forming friendships based on some kind of common interest. Well, in order for it to be Christian love, that common interest needs to be some virtue, or virtue, several virtues, not virtue in general, because there is no such thing as virtue in general. Virtue is always specific and particular, some particular virtue. You know, so this is how we form oneness with another person. Sometimes what's happened in history, as far as religion is concerned, is people have come up with a set of principles that they agree on, and then another group will come up with other set of principles that they agree on, and then they fight. You know, and they fought the 30 Years' War after the Protestant Reformation, when everybody kind of broke up into lots of different groups and they all decided what they thought, and then they just had wars. This is not the Christian way of life. The Christian way of life is to form friendship with others based on the pursuit of some virtue. And you might have friendship in one case that is focused on one virtue, and another friend where, you know, another virtue is the center of that friendship. And so it's the opposite of condemning others because they don't follow a certain principle that you've come up with, that you may or may not even be a good example of yourself. So there is the fact that we need to deal with things within ourselves, and between ourselves and another person, there can be this oneness of a common pursuit of some virtue that binds you together. That's the foundation of a Christian society, of a Christian community. That's what should be happening in parish life. Sometimes we try to keep peace by worldly means. That's not what we should be doing. We should all be working on our inner life, and when it comes to others, not condemning them, not judging them, loving the person and suffering for them when they are afflicted by some sin that plagues them, instead of judging them for that. And that's how you resist evil in others. You resist evil in others by not letting that evil define that person in your mind, in your heart, because then you will condemn that person. Sharon's looking quizzical. She's wondering maybe she should have kept reading this book.
Maybe I should
have. It is a good book. It is a very good book. And that was the thing that I think was most closely related to what we're talking about. Bottom of page 101, how can we avoid increase of evil? Forgiveness of personal offenses, top of 102. So when it comes to personal offenses, we are expected to forgive them. And when we try to forgive a personal offense, we will have a battle in our soul. And we are meant to make that struggle within ourselves. Against the feeling of vindictiveness, one who is capable of forgiving personal offenses will live calmly and peacefully, not feeling bitter against anyone and not sowing any evil discord or unrest. So this is the second time that he's emphasized this idea that, you know, the first time it came up is when he said that the bottom of 100, people who have forgiven personal offenses will cease to be bearers and disseminators, spreaders of evil. And that if everybody did this, evil would disappear. And now he's saying over here on page top of page 102, one who is capable of forgiving personal offenses will live calmly and peacefully, not feeling bitter against anyone, nor sowing any evil discord or unrest. So this is the primary way that we have of resisting evil. About three lines from the bottom of that paragraph, he defines sin as doing evil. Lots of times people will try to confess attitudes or tendencies or something like that, but a sin is doing something. To sin means to do evil, and true love does not even think evil. Now we deal with thoughts of evil, but to sin means to do evil. A true Christian is a bearer of the peace of Christ in his soul, and we have to deal with our passions. You could call them negative emotions, but generally they're called passions traditionally, within ourselves, in order to have this kind of peace. By no means cherish all peace, as we were saying before. There can be glorious discord as well as disastrous oneness or unanimity. People can be one in some vice. I got into that in the sermon this past week somewhat. People who are moved by a common passion will glom together and go against others who are moved by some other passion. And then you have all kinds of terrible conflict in that kind of way. But glorious discord, what could that be? Can anybody tell me what glorious discord could be?
I don't know.
I was not going to ask that question. I decided not to.
Discord caused by the ability to forgive? I don't know. And that's just, I kind of had that question as well.
Yeah.
You know, when one finds the ability to forgive others, you know, what if others, that causes discord with others because they don't agree?
One possibility that is not unrelated to what you've just said is this. What if we are going about trying to love the sinner and forgive the sin? What if others say, that's wrong? You know, that's immoral what you're doing, to love these horrible people who do these horrible things. I think there could be great discord there. That's one example. But we should have the courage say, no, this person is not evil. What they do is evil. And the best example, the most topical example I can think of today, and Pope Francis has been a good example of this kind of thing, when it comes to homosexuals. Homosexuals are unpalatable to heterosexuals at a selfish level. Doing homosexual acts is sinful. But if a person is born with a tendency to have desire for a person of the same gender, is that an evil person? Or is it just the sins that they might conceivably do? Because after all, just because we are heterosexual and a man loves women, does that mean it's okay for him to engage in promiscuous sexuality because he's not homosexual? No, we reject that. It's for marriage. It's not to indulge that passion. And it's the same for heterosexuals and for homosexuals. The indulgence of sexual passion is not acceptable. It's sinful. It has nothing to do with your, well, they call it sexual orientation. I guess that's the simplest way. It has nothing to do with that. If someone is plagued by a passion and a desire, our heart goes out to that person who is in bondage to that passion and that desire. We are expected to love that person with Christian love, not to condemn them because the passion that they are fighting with is not the same as the passion that we are fighting with. Because it's being bound by passions or acting according to bondage to passion that is sinful. It's the action. Acting in bondage to a passion is not free and is sinful. It has nothing to do with gender orientation. Where it would justify our condemning homosexuals as homosexuals because of their sexual orientation. Now, if someone says that, couldn't there be glorious discord? Because you are standing up for the reality of the fact that Christian love means loving others who may be unpalatable to us, and we want to condemn them and say, no, you're morally terrible, and we need to have control over you people because that's the way you are. The fact is, I'm that way too, just not in that way. My passions and desires are not the same passions and desires, but it's not like some passions and desires are privileged and others aren't. That is a human condemnation of other human beings that are not the same as I am. And that, I think, can cause a great deal of discord. Pope Francis has caused a lot of glorious discord. That seems to be what he's about. Just cleaning up the finances of the Vatican is leading him into a lot of glorious discord, because it's wrong. It's wrong. So he has the courage to do that. It makes you wonder. I mean, I have this long string of popes who just didn't pay any attention to it at all. How could that be? You know, but he's not doing it. He doesn't. He's not afraid. What do people think about that? That's a lot of discord there, I think.
Bringing things to light and creating change from within.
Would glorious discord be when you're with your relatives at a family reunion and they're all talking about how everyone has their differences, but we're all Christians here, and that's cool that you go to this Calvinistic church and we go to this other church, and you guys are Orthodox, right, Stephen or us? And we're like, glorious discord would be like to say, well, you know, we do believe that the Orthodox Church is the church, and we'd like you to be a part of it too. That could be a glorious discord.
It could be.
You hope, because we don't believe that Calvin and everything else is just a-okay, you know?
I think it would depend on whether or not they could hear those words. I think the term applies. I'm not sure it's an example of what Archbishop Averky means. I think he'll give some examples here, and maybe we should look at those. Okay, the standard is love only peace that has a good purpose, that unites with God. So we would have to ask ourselves, would bringing that up on Thanksgiving, so would they saying that on Thanksgiving, would it have the good purpose of uniting someone with God? Or would it just be a kind of, you know, running up the flag? They used to say, show the flag. You know, in Vietnam, when they didn't have anybody to fight, they would just go around through the jungle with the flag and they'd find somebody to fight. So showing the flag is not always a good idea. You might want to be humble.
Yeah.
You know, and you could probably let people know that you didn't completely agree with that without saying very much.
Right.
You know, without witnessing in a way that would not bring people into union with God, but might be more likely to bring discord that wasn't maybe so glorious after all.
I can see a certain situation happening soon where I work, where this 25-year-old young man who's married, he's the son of a guy that I work with, and they're going to Macedonia to be missionaries there. But they're hidden. They're not calling themselves missionaries because the Muslims there will kill them.
Yeah.
So what they're really going to do is to minister to, they're going to try to reach out to the people who've been Orthodox for thousands of years and reach them with Protestantism, you know. And what's going to happen is, let's pass around a bucket at work and see who wants to give to this, you know. But glorious discord for me would be, I can't live to that. I mean, I just can't, because I'm not into seeing Orthodox Christians, you know, being brought to some other, be proselytized to be something other than what they were, what they've been for all these years, you know.
So 2,000
Orthodox will convert them.
That's happened, actually.
Yes.
Years of persecution couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Well, Archbishop Averke goes on to say, this is an example of glorious discord. Page 104, three quarters of the way down, just before the beginning of the last paragraph. Christ himself, the humble teacher of love, took up a whip and drove out those selling in the temple and turned over the money changers' tables and scattered their money. And that is an example of glorious discord, I think. But he could do that. It was his father's house. If we did it, we would be claiming to be the Son of God. I think that's critical. You know, to the idea, well, Jesus got angry, you know, he did this, and so it's okay for me. No, I think the situation was very specific. He is the incarnate Son of God. He comes to the temple, and the temple is being sacrilegiously used as a place to trade animals that will be sacrificed for the advantage of who? Not for the advantage of those who are sacrificing the animals according to the law of Moses, to bring brothers together who have been separated by anger or strife or something like that. That's the purpose of the sacrifice. But who's being benefited? The money changers. They're making a profit. They've turned it into a house of monetary exchange. And the Son of God, God incarnate, comes and stands against it. He is the appropriate authority to do that. If we take that authority on ourselves, and I've heard people point to this example and say, well, Jesus did this. Yeah, and who are you? Are you the one that can say, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord? Are you the Son of God? Are you the appropriate authority to call these people in the temple to an account? He was, but we're not. But that is an example of glorious discord, it does seem to me. His peace is not just laying down and accepting the desecration of the temple for the sake of worldly harmony. The Romans might come and say, listen, this guy's a troublemaker. And the head of the temple and the Sanhedrin, that might say, look, this guy is causing trouble. But he is the one who has the right to cause trouble. He's the appropriate authority, which is a critical part of the way Archbishop Averke talks about how to deal with evil in the world. It has to do with appropriate authorities. Just below the center of page 103, it says, when the gospel speaks of the forgiveness of sins and offenses, it has in mind personal sins and personal offenses. We can forgive those. However, we usually understand and do everything the other way around. Assertive human pride forgives everything except for personal offenses. Things don't bother us in the society that we live in unless we personally are offended, and then we get upset, then we get angry. So this, it's completely different from the way the world around us functions. On page 105, in the middle, it says, "There exist in society legitimate authorities and those whose duty it is to preserve order. Let every soul be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and the authorities that exist are appointed by God. Therefore, whoever resists the authority resists the ordinance of God." So, the word of God at the bottom of 105 itself blesses, in case of need, the use of the sword by legitimate authorities for the suppression of evil. However, the authorities should remember that they are God's ministers, and therefore the sword should by no means be used for personal aims, but in order to defend the truth of God and the punishment of those who do evil. So authorities exist in the world to punish those who do evil. I am not the appropriate authority to go out and punish evil. Even though we have the Second Amendment, we all have a gun, we're going to go out and punish some evil. We won't have to look far for it, because there's a lot of evil in the world. But the evil star that we need to deal with first is inside of the person who wants to go around and be the vigilante. Because, according to Archbishop Averke, that's why we have appropriate authorities in the world. City governments, state, federal governments, policemen, keep civil order. If we all think that it's up to us to straighten things out with a gun, I don't know how those people can claim to be, they couldn't claim to be Orthodox Christians, it doesn't seem to me. When it comes to the punishment of those who do evil, from this point of view, the church justifies war as an extreme, unavoidable measure for the suppression of even greater evil, to keep things from getting even more evil than they are now. So there's this distinction between the evil that we can deal with ourselves, which is largely within us, and beyond that has to do with, it seems to me, uniting ourselves to others in friendship that is centered on the common pursuit of some virtue. That's what we can do as individuals. You know, when it comes to outside of ourselves, we forgive others their sins, we love the sinner and hate the sin, we don't accept the sin and form a friendship based on the fact that, well, I can understand why you'd be interested in that particular sin. I kind of have a tendency in that direction myself. So I can accept there is that kind of tendency toward that particular sin in me, and so we'll be friends because we're moved by a similar passion, a similar desire. No, we don't get to do that. And it might be a glorious discord between ourselves and the other person. But the glorious discord is that while I love you, I hate the sin, and so where is the foundation for our friendship? You know? So that's how it works. The main distinction in the chapter has to do with how you resist evil within yourself, and on the other hand, how you are prohibited from resisting evil out in the world, as though you were the proper authority, which you aren't. And then when he goes beyond that, on page 107, he gives the example of someone who may try to take something that belongs to you. Jesus said, if someone tries to take your shirt, give them the shirt off your back. This is a matter of the relationship between ourselves and others in a particular case. And Archbishop Averke gives an example of that kind of case. If your brother, driven to despair by hunger and want, and forgetting all sense of shame and his conscience, stretches his hand out to your property, what should I tell you to do in this case? Doesn't your own heart tell you that this is not the time for resistance and punishment, but for compassion and mercy. Doesn't your common sense tell you that this is not some common predator who needs to be restrained, but an unfortunate person who needs to be saved from starvation, an embittered person whose calloused heart needs to be softened with sympathy and love? In this case, fulfill the command of the Lord literally. If he demands your outer garment, give him your shirt also. That is, give him more than he asks of you to try to win the person's heart. Even according to criminal law, such an offender is distinguished from the common criminal, and his punishment is lightened. So there's the exception. You have the way we are called to live, dealing with evil within ourselves, unite ourselves to others on the basis of common pursuit of purity of heart, is what Abba Joseph says. You pursue purification of the heart by focusing on a particular virtue outside of ourselves. There are authorities that deal with things, you know, and then there is the exception, which even those authorities make for someone who steals a loaf of bread to keep from starving. It's still theft, but in court that person will be dealt with differently. And we should go further than that, as Jesus does, and if we see somebody starving and they try to take bread from us, we give them some butter and peanut butter and jelly to go along with it to keep them from starving. I mean, that's common compassion and charitable love. What do people think? Is there any of this that runs counter to our general way of thinking about things?
Well, I saw for my birthday, one of my parents, my dad, I guess, gave me this book of the lives of the saints for the month of November.
Uh-huh.
It's amazing, the thickness.
Yeah, yeah, for me with those books, yeah. Just think there's 12 of those.
Yeah. The first day was done about around page 50, I think it was.
Yeah? First
somewhere
day?
Around there. Yeah, the first day of November. Anyways,
November 1st.
Yeah. We were reading Saints Cosmas and Damien.
Right, right.
And in that story, I saw something that may be seems like a good example of two common people who've decided that they love this one virtue. It was talking about how they talked and decided that they were not going to take anything for what they did because it was given by God. And one was, well, one lady came and said very persuasive, she felt really bad because they wouldn't take the three eggs that she was giving them, or giving one of the brothers. And so he intended to show compassion and take the eggs in that case. But then when he told his brother was weeping, and they were wondering if they were still going to be unmercenaries after they took her. And this big deal for them, but they decided on that virtue.
Right. So their shared virtue was compassion.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
These were the ones of Asia.
So what did they do about that? About those eggs?
Well, the one brother didn't even want to be buried with his brother anymore. But when they were deciding whether to, I mean, they stayed together and continued to work.
So we overcame that. You know, he didn't condemn his brother for accepting the eggs and never forgive him.
Well,
didn't he? I hope not.
He, being a saint, I believe, forgave.
Uh-huh.
But what happened in the end, after they were passed and they didn't know where to bury them, God opened the mouth of a donkey and it said that it's God's will that they be buried together, knowing the intention of the brother.
So that was maybe an example of glorious discord, you know, to striving to outdo one another for the sake of the virtue of compassion, which when it's resolved, then becomes part of the effort that they shared in common. It sounds very much like what happens in marriage a lot to me. Those kinds of conflicts come up. Yeah. That's a good example. Mm-hmm. Always remember that we are not fighting against the people in and of themselves, but with the evil that comes from them. And he says, the evil that comes from them, because remember, human beings are able to bring evil into the world, and this is what happens when we do when we do something that is evil. There is evil in the world that would not have needed to be there because of the fact that we did something that was evil. Human beings have that capacity because not because we were created to be like that, but we were created to be actually the opposite way and to bring things together in a good way, you know, and offer them up to God. But because we have that capacity, it can be turned upside down, and when it is, this is what happens. You know, we do something that is evil, and it brings evil into the world. Because evil always has consequences. God forgives the sin, but the consequences still exist. The consequences of the evil that we have done. We can try to do something about it. If we've stolen something, and it's possible, we can return it. Or if we've offended someone, we can ask their forgiveness. But there's a difference between the evil thing that we've done and the consequences which go beyond us. So for that reason, he's saying, the evil that comes from that. We don't get to condemn another person because evil has come from them. And people will use this argument. They will say, well, look at this person that you want to be so forgiving of and compassionate toward and forgive, because they have done something that has affected other people in a bad way. Yes, that's true. Those consequences do need to be dealt with, but it doesn't mean that you condemn the person or fight against the person. You deal with the consequences that came from the evil act. Evil is not something that belongs to the person who did it. It's something that's foreign to every human being. Even when we do evil, we're doing something that is foreign to us. The consequences are not from the person that God created. They're from the person misusing the freedom that God gave us. It's a fine point, but it's an important one. Feelings of mercy and compassion are never absent from a true Christian and should always direct us in this battle, because we're struggling against evil consequences and we're still forgiving the person who may have done something that they should not have done. Abhor the evil, but love the man and pity him. Therefore, our battle with people who have become bearers of evil should have the purpose of the suppression of the evil that is performed by them, and should in no way be vindictive. And that will be our temptation. That's something that we'll need to deal with inside of ourselves, and evil inside of ourselves. St. Paul says, beloved, do not avenge yourself, but rather give place to wrath. For it is written, give place to wrath. Or what place, what do we give? We give place to the anger. What we put in its place is Christ's peace and love. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord, not us. In battling with manifestations of evil in others, we should at the same time, with no less zealousness and fervency, concern ourselves with uprooting evil in our own souls. Otherwise, our struggle will be hypocritical. We won't be standing against evil. We'll be using something that has been done in order to condemn another person and put ourselves in the place of God. So our struggle against evil will be without fruit if that's what we do, for such a struggle will not have the blessing of God. A battle that is accompanied by personal motives will not bring good to anyone. And this last paragraph I would put together like this. Only one who does not bind oneself to worldly acquisitions, that is, who does not get tangled up in any type of personal interests or obsessions, not just wealth or physical things that you own, but any type of personal interests or obsessions, but one who thinks only of defending God's desecrated truth and the triumph of the gospel, Only such a person can successfully battle with evil. Okay.
Personal interests and obsessions preclude being able to battle evil.
Sure. If you are tangled up with those things, you are not going to be able to battle evil because you've got to deal with yourself, deal with those obsessions, those interests. Okay. Anybody else? We can make some final observations, summaries, comments.
Be still inside.
Right. And you know, the thing is, it's not as though we necessarily need to have, we can't say that we've totally accomplished stillness. But if our desire is to have stillness, inner stillness, inner peace, then we will be able to engage in the spiritual struggle within ourselves. And the actively doing that, that's what we are expected to do. In the Layman in the Desert book, he mentions that we are always responsible to try to make things the way they ought to be. We are it doesn't mean that we will always be successful, but we are responsible to try. We're responsible to make the effort within ourselves and between ourselves and another person to remove anger, replace it with compassion, and to make our relationship with other persons, relationships that are friendships based on a common devotion to virtue. And we can look for that in other people. It's interesting how if you get to know someone, you will find that people have a commitment that is just kind of ingrained in them. Lots of people do, that you wouldn't expect. And that's an opportunity for making a friendship based on that effort, that common desire for the development of that virtue.
I think if you love them, then you'll see those things in them.
I think that's true too. That it's remarkable that we don't see anything. We cannot see anything of another person if we don't have some love or compassion for them.
Yeah.
They're invisible to us without that.
Eyes to the heart need to be open.
Right. Okay. Thank you. Next chapter, chapter 9, Waging Unseen Warfare. This is not as short a chapter. This is a longer chapter.